Hello, and welcome to episode 97 of the Planning Period Podcast, your Ed Breakroom. I'm your host, Brad Treffler. This week on the show, I'm joined by Cheyenne Batista, the founder and CEO of Firefly Worldwide, a new global education consulting firm. She is a former New York City teacher and moved into coaching teachers and then to the corporate world. Cheyenne and I talk about the difference between high-quality schools and high-quality instructors, how sitting in our discomfort is the work of fixing problems, especially with problems of inequity, the gap between what we need to prepare students for and what we are actually doing in school, why all humans, including educators, need to listen more, and how one person at a school who wants to make a school more inclusive can change lives. So sit back and enjoy episode 97 of the Planning Period Podcast, my interview with Cheyenne Batista.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to this episode of the Planning Period Podcast. I'm your host, as always, Brad Treffler. And in continuing with our post-ISTE series of interviews on the show, I'm really excited today to be joined by someone who I got to see present and had just a phenomenal voice in terms of equity and equity issues and social issues in the classroom, and really just brought it at ISTE for the session I saw. And my friend Emily that was with me said the other session she saw was amazing too. And so I'm really excited to be joined today by Cheyenne Batista. How are you doing today?
Hi, Brad. I'm doing wonderful. Thanks so much for having me on. This is always a lot of fun.
Hey, absolutely. I was, like I said, I loved what I saw at ISTE. I think if I remember right, I caught in the middle of one of your sessions. I had been somewhere else and had to walk out and was like passing by. And my friend was like, hey, you got to come see this session. You'll love it. And I caught the second half and loved it. So really excited to get to talk to you. But for the rest of my audience, could you introduce yourself? Tell me a little bit about who you are and your space in education.
Yes, thanks so much. And I'm really glad to hear that about the session. You know, as you, I'm sure, know, being a teacher, sometimes you're standing up there going, are they with me? Is this good stuff? So it's great to hear that your colleague was having a good time. And I'm really glad to be on. So thanks for having me. Yeah. A little bit about what I do. So I currently am the founder and CEO of a new and budding global consulting firm. I consult with education and nonprofit leaders, any visionary leader with a mission that they're trying to achieve brilliantly. So the name of the company is called Firefly Worldwide. And we support leaders to shine brilliantly by achieving missions with a level of intentionality and a level of excellence that can sometimes be difficult when we dive into the work. So I started out as a teacher. I taught for several years in New York City's Department of Education. That's where I grew up in the education. It's the school system that educated me. And after I went off to coach and teach coach teachers for a while, I worked in a data assessment reporting company in the corporate world, wanting to dabble there and thinking that that was the corporate life was for me. And I learned pretty quickly that it wasn't thoroughly my cup of tea, but I learned some great lessons about data assessment reporting and the role that data plays in classrooms in both really helpful but also potentially very challenging ways. And over time, I ended up leaving the U.S. to teach at a wonderful private school in São Paulo in Brazil. It's called Escola Americana de Campinas. It's American School of Campinas. And it was, I always look back on that experience in a really treasured way because it was my first time working and honestly being in a well-resourced school. I had gone to schools that were a bit challenged and had taught in really challenging schools. So it was my first time seeing schools that were really well-resourced and had such a long-standing community, teachers who had been in the community for over 20 years. Everyone knew everyone's name. There was a lot of love for the students and a great sense of what good learning looks like. And so I really enjoyed that time. And that painted a great picture for me of the type of schools that I think all students deserve. So I left Brazil and I went to study education policy and management at Harvard and for my graduate degree. And I left Harvard really excited about the possibility to build schools. So I joined an organization called East Harlem Tutorial Program. They were looking for a founding principal to design and run its first charter school. And we built over time, a community network of charter schools called East Harlem Scholars Academies. where I got to build from scratch and from the ground up what is now a K and soon to be 12, K through 12 network of elementary, middle, and now opening a high school. But I've since stepped down and have been running my consulting firm ever since, and I get to work with all kind of exciting folks around the globe trying to do really excellent work in education and other nonprofits.
Huh. All right. A lot of places to go. I'm sitting here taking notes as you talk. I got like five different directions I want to talk about. So while we were at ISTE, I heard you talk a little bit about Firefly Worldwide. And I don't think it hit me in that moment as much as it did now how ambitious the mission is. It's like, I want to fix the American education system with my podcast, which still seems ambitious most times, and you just want to fix the world. So how does that happen? How did you get to that point?
I think the inspiration came from just, you know, the career path I just talked about. I've met many, many, many great people along the way, really phenomenal leaders, really passionate and committed leaders. But I think we still all look back, whether you're in the U.S. or you're in other countries, and you look at, I'll speak for myself, I look back and still see a society where there's lots of wonderful things happening, but there's still significantly sized communities that are deeply yearning for better resources, better opportunities. And so I think it can be difficult for visionary leaders at times to both hold a clear sense of the vision and the goals that they set forth for themselves and dive into the really challenging aspects of the on-the-ground work and somehow marry the two to get the results that they originally set out to achieve. And though education is my major passion, this happens across sectors. And I kind of have an eye for digging into organizations that do this type of work and really have the best intentions in mind and somehow see the challenges get in the way of the goals. So whether it's leaders who are starting from scratch and want to design a vision from, design a program from a great vision they have in their brain to having built their strategic plan but not sure how to execute it, or in some cases, organizations that have been around for a really long time and want to get better at their practice, that I feel really inspired working with leaders who are committed to doing great work in the communities they serve.
It's interesting to me because when I saw you presented ISTE, your specific session title, it was that schools often perpetuate inequity. And it was a great session and you talked about the ways that that's true and I buy it 100%. But it's interesting that with Firefly, you enjoy working with the people that are already doing the work. And I thought you were so great at challenging the people in the room who weren't doing the work, if that makes any sense. Like, totally. It's not that there's one is good and one is bad. It's just interesting the disconnect or the distance, I guess is probably a better way to say that, the distance between those two. So I don't even know 100% where to take this. You know, the other thing I put in my notes there is you said that it wasn't until you went to Sao Paulo, Brazil, that you found a well-resourced school. And I think from the American-centric perspective, to say that you had to go to South America to find a well-resourced school is like an insult in a lot of ways, and yet 100% the reality of what we're dealing with.
Right. Yeah, I say it obviously cautiously, and I love the country that I was born in, and I work really hard because I'm passionate about it for a reason. As for all of its ups and downs, I'm really committed to our American school system, and you know, it's with no knock to the really hard work that's happening here. For me in particular, because I came from a pretty modest background myself, and then chose to go back into the school system that I came from, it just meant that I had not at that point in my career had a ton of exposure to really high quality schools. I definitely had a ton of exposure to people working really hard and to schools that were achieving success in different pockets of the work that they were doing. But I, up until that point, had not yet been in a school community where the way I like to describe it is there was just a level of course. And I talk about this a lot. And it just meant that because of the nature of the community and when you are functioning in schools where, you know, in this case, it's a very affluent student population. This was an American school, so it was lots of American expats who were living in the country, and then also the children of lots of executives and VPs who wanted their kids to graduate school and be competitive for American universities. It just meant that there was a level of expectation for what the students received there on a daily basis that is, I can't say has been consistently the case within the schools that I was working in. Now, it's obviously in different school systems. I was working in traditional public schools and at some point at different charters. But this is the private school system where obviously the resources are a lot different and expectations were a lot different as well. So it's just a good sort of insight into this is what it looks like when teachers stay for a really long time and they stay and are supported. They have the resources that are needed, the facilities that are needed, and there's just a level of the community working collectively to ensure that the students are successful.
What I'm hearing, and just to extrapolate bits and pieces of this, is I'm hearing this kind of distinction between high quality schools versus, or in conjunction with, high quality educators.
For sure.
And it's tough to me because on a lot of levels, what I try to do is work with educators to make them high quality educators. And it doesn't, I don't want to say it doesn't matter because that's not the right way to put it. But at the same time, I think there can be high quality educators in every environment. And I think it's harder for high quality educators to stay in a non-supported environment, whether that's not supported financially, whether that's not supported by leadership, whether that's not supported by whatever. I think it's harder for educators to stay when they're not supported, but high quality educators can exist in either case. And what I would love to see in this perfect world, and I like to believe my school is working towards, is having both of those things at the same time. But I wonder if it's that connection that we're missing, or is there something else I'm not seeing from your perspective?
Well, yeah, and it's why I emphasize that the comment on seeing that contrast for me was definitely no knock to any of the individuals within the schools that I had worked with. It's just what you said. There's so many times either great educators or folks with great intentions or maybe a beautiful facility but a lack of training. Running great schools takes a very careful marriage of many elements happening all at the same time. I ran schools for 7 years and every day woke up wondering if I was doing what I had set out to do. And we were accomplishing so many great things. It's just, you experience success in one area and suddenly the fire pops up in the next, or there's a new challenge that emerges. And so in any type of school, whether it's traditional district schools, private schools, charters, magnets, it's often the case that great intentions are there. They're wonderful instances of excellence. But when you step back and look at the big picture, there tends to be a gap, whether it's around resources, whether it's around access to professional development, whether it's around adequate training, whether it's around retention, as you just spoke about, and what, you get all these great teachers, you train them up, the school's running really well. Are you now running a school where those teachers then stay and they get to know the students and the families? Is there a really active family engagement plan, and are families being engaged as true members of the community as opposed to just accessories? It really just depends on the type of school and what the belief system is of the leaders involved, and obviously, the policies and practices and the politics in the given district, neighborhood, community that the school is serving.
If you think of this in equation terms or in scientific terms of the variables that we're trying to deal with, right? Like, if your goal is this beautiful, perfect school, it's too many variables to try to justify, right? But I think I kind of keep going back to this idea of individual issues of not every instructor being a high quality instructor, and system-wide issues of not every school and not every district being a high quality school and a high quality district. And it's like, it almost feels like you need to attack this on two or three fronts. And I guess that's probably true in any system-wide issue, right? I guess that's probably, now that I think about it, like any system-wide issue requires that kind of dedication or multi-pronged attack, but it feels daunting as I think about it in that frame.
Absolutely. It's really tough. It's a tough thing to get to do well.
Wow. Well, before we get to my first real question, I want to bring you back to something that you said and at ISTE that I really appreciated. You know, I wrote about this on my blog, actually, because I wrote a reflection on sort of what I saw when you spoke. And one of the quotes that I had pulled out particularly is that you pointed out, number one, that we are not going to be here to save the world from inequities, because we're not going to accomplish that in a room full of arguably enlightened educators looking to change the world. Right. We're not going to do that in that room.
Right.
But the thing you really said that stuck with me is that this conversation, and there's a quote, this conversation will not end, will end with no closure, and that is the work.
Mm.
And I thought that was such an interesting way to paint it. And listeners will remember my episode with Jen Bennis of Ed History 101, who is phenomenal, and left me in a complete moral and ethical quandary by the end of that episode. Because that is the work, right? And I thought that was such a profound way to put it, because sitting in that discomfort is the work, right? So if we start to tackle issues of inequity, and we start to tackle issues of racism, when we start to tackle the stuff that schools are perpetuating on a systemic level, it is, and I think if I remember right, you said this too, it is not to vilify an individual. It is to look at a system, try to find the problems, and then at least consider what we might do about them. But the lack of solution is the work. And I thought that was such a profound way to put things.
Yeah, I think that we are so often programmed to want to walk into a given time period or experience and have a checklist and be able to sort of check things off the list and consider them, you know, accomplished and done. And I think we can, you know, veer even more towards that type of habit when we're diving into the uncomfortable. And I've had the privilege of training what is now hundreds and hundreds of teachers over the years. And in almost all circumstances, we've addressed topics of inequity in our professional development. And it is probably one of the most difficult aspects of the work, which is, it is until we see the day where every single child is born into whatever zip code, whatever neighborhood, whatever continent, as my work now becomes global, until we see the day where kids can count on waking up and getting and having access to a free public education that really meets their needs, that celebrates them as an individual, that delivers to them curriculum that feels really relevant to their experiences while also opening their minds to worlds unseen. Until that's the case for every child, and until you can take a look at the places where that's not happening, and there's no predictor along race lines, along socioeconomics, or any other markers that tend to be the trend in who's getting underserved or not served in ways that they deserve. Until that's the case, the conversation's just not done. And so there's no one session, there's no one PD series, professional development series, there's no one documentary, there's no one TED Talk. It's really just a commitment on everyone, every educator's behalf. And first of all, recognizing that this is an issue, because I think we are still a far, far away. It always shocks me, but it is the case. We are far away from the point where all educators feel compelled that this is an issue, and an issue that connects to them in their classrooms, whether they are teaching in the South Bronx, where it's majority Black and brown children, or they're in the middle of a rural town in Kentucky somewhere, where they may not see many brown faces, although, you know, even in rural towns in Kentucky, there are brown faces too. But whether your student demographic reflects deeply the dominant culture, high-income students, or you're serving the students who have been most historically marginalized, it's not until we get to the point that every educator sees themselves implicated in the work that we're going to get there. So the first step is getting everyone to, feel on board that this is a priority and it's an area we should all be thinking about. And then, yes, there's so many aspects of inequity. It's not just about race. Race is a huge issue, and racism is a huge issue, and it's a helpful and important starting point. But there's obviously all the other isms that take a really long time, and it takes points of deep reflection, vulnerability, humility, openness to new perspectives. And that type of work takes, for some people, just years to get to a place where they can really both internalize these issues, but also prepare themselves as educators to tackle it in the classroom, because it's already difficult to be a great teacher. It is already difficult to be a great school leader, and it's already difficult to be a great parent. That's without the complexities of inequity. Add on this new layer, and it's really challenging. I think also what I'd say is that working with inequity is really twofold, because in any given moment, one must both contend with what's happening internally. That's all the internalized biases that we ourselves have internalized through society and all the messages in our own upbringings, while also teaching students that they are there and what to do about them. So it's a multifaceted, simultaneous work that just doesn't get tackled or conquered within one conference session or with one great TED talk. And so it's a, you know, sort of like learning how to cook really well over time. It's not just one class you take. It's really diving in deeply and understanding all the facets of what makes a great cook. So I'm hoping our listeners are feeling committed to diving in and really unpacking all that's there, so we can all be a little bit more on our way towards running classrooms and schools that really meet the needs of students in these ways.
Yeah. You know, it's those complexities. And I think the interconnected complexities, you know, you talk about, I think it's easy to think about racism and all the isms as their own thing. Like, they're individualized situations that we can tackle one at a time. And I don't know that you can do that, because I think in a lot of ways they're connected, they're based on the same issues, and it's like, I don't know, I think it's become easy for large portions of our population in the U.S. to imagine that equality is now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think in a lot of ways President Obama made that easy for a bunch of ignorant people to say, look, inequality's gone. And if you can credit Trump with one positive thing, it is making it abundantly clear to anyone watching that all of the isms definitely still exist in a very serious way in this country. So it's so odd that, And I'm sure you've seen this. I can only imagine, because I know I've gotten pushback on some of those episodes of my podcast that people didn't agree with or felt like they were individually under attack as a result of the conversations on that show. Like, you get, I have to imagine you also have gotten that pushback, right?
Absolutely. I think we are, you know, if there's one thing I am grateful for around social media, is that it gives us a chance, you know, it gives us a footstep into many people's living rooms that we don't have access to. And you get to hear what dinner table talk sounds like in a lot of different homes that, you know, both reflect your own views and in some ways become the echo chamber, but even more powerfully and sometimes harmfully into the living rooms of those who have really harmful views and live a bit blinded by the ways in which these issues are deeply relevant. And it's challenging, but for sure there are, I would say that even in the current era with our, you know, our current administration and just the headlines that seem to spew out every single day, I can't say actually that we're in a place where folks are convinced and that feels clear. It certainly feels clear to me. It sounds like it feels clear to you. It feels clear to many of my colleagues and the scholars who I respect and admire the most. But yeah, we still have a lot of work to do in convincing folks that what's in front of us is real, and that hearing and being able to empathize with the perspective of others, even when it's not the case that it is most directly relevant to one's own life, like being able to do that is an important skill. And I can't say that we're there as a society. So yes, I've definitely been in the conversations, or certainly have been scrolling through them, where there's still a lot more convincing to do. And it's not until we are in the place where we're a little bit closer to being on the same page that that we'll see some more the needed headway in this work.
Yeah. Yeah. We're already like 24 minutes in. I feel like I'm already challenged and pressed, and I have a great conversation already. So I'm excited to move into the questions that I ask all my guests. And I have to be honest here, because this is what my show is, and I just do this. You're one of only like two guests that have really pushed to get the questions in advance. So I'm going to throw that out there right now. Just let everybody know.
That's fine. That's fair.
Cheyenne really wanted these questions.
I'm a reflective person. I'm so bad on the spot. I like to, you know, I like to mull over things and, you know.
Thankfully, I was busy today, so I didn't get to send them to you too early.
That's true.
I wish I could say I did that on purpose. It was not on purpose. I really just have been busy.
But, well, what I promise you is I'm going to give you my visceral reactions.
All right. Well, that I appreciate. So with that said, let's move on into my first question for all my guests. And the first question is always, what is the biggest problem facing education today?
Thank you. And thanks for being flexible and sharing that question, because I did have a chance to think about it, you know, a little bit. And I think the conversation that we just had just leading up to this, you know, literally in this moment, is a perfect segue. Because when you asked the question, what immediately came to mind is, I mean, I can list 100 challenges, but if I had to boil it down to what strikes me as the biggest is that we are in a place, well, first of all, I would frame it as a challenge more than a problem. But it is a problem, but I approach problems as challenges all the time. So the challenge that's most burning on my mind is we are in a place where we need to prepare students for new contexts that we just simply can't imagine. And maybe that's the same thing that we would have been able to say, you know, half a century ago. There are jobs now that I'm sure, you know, 50 years ago, we weren't fathoming. So I'd say maybe it's the continuation of that challenge. But in particular, because technology is moving so rapidly, we're needing to prepare students for jobs that we'll never be able to imagine and to move at a pace that we've never been moving at before. And that's in the context of still seeing that our literacy rates, for example, across the country are not where they need to be. The capacity for students to think critically and analyze and to process information in the ways they need are not where they need to be. And that's, you know, often when we say that, people immediately jump and think about communities where there's just the presumption that there's a level of underperforming, whether it's low-income communities or some of our students of color. But I mean, literally across the country, if you just look at literacy rates across the board, if you look at college attendance rates and college completion rates across the board, there's that. But also thinking about the world of climate change, thinking about where we are in terms of foreign policy, thinking about all these equity issues that we're talking about. We have a job as educators to make sure that students are not just leaving able to read, write, and do the basics of math, but to function successfully in contexts that we can't quite put to words yet. And so that means just being able to ask the questions, analyze the texts. I think the biggest thing that has led to my own success, just being a first-generation college student, I've spent my entire academic career sort of figuring things out independently. And it of course, meant pulling on the networks around me and pulling around really supportive people around me. But what drove my ability to do that is that I could sit in a room and read through something and my literacy skills would help me to analyze what's in front of me and sort of figure things out on my own. So I think the biggest challenge is being able to instill in students the skills that are needed to really be successful in multiple contexts.
Just by nature of the problem, how do we prepare students for a context that we can't articulate?
So I think it's a bit of what I said. So it's the it's this analysis skills. It's the ability for a child. I think about it like a puzzle. It's the ability to throw a ton of puzzle pieces at a child, and they can piece them together to get to the ultimate outcome. And that's, you know, whether you're differentiating with zero guidance or accompanying them along the way, or doing it hand in hand. You know, if the puzzle can serve as an analogy, if you will, for any sort of context where there are a ton of context clues and it's a new circumstance and the student is not deeply familiar, they're able to use whether they're the literacy skills we talked about, tech skills, their capacity to analyze and to piece together what's needed in order to succeed.
The other thing you said that I found fascinating, and it was maybe a twist or maybe it's just the way I heard it, but I always think about issues of equity and equality and eliminating bias as the thing we need right now. And something in the way you phrased it, I guess I should say, not only the thing we need right now, but the thing that's just morally right. And I always struggle with this discussion with people who don't see the problems, because I feel like they're just oblivious to the morally right. And something about the way you phrased it made me consider that eliminating issues of bias, racism, sexism, ageism, whatever one we want to throw at it, are necessary for the future needs of our current children. Because as I think about it, the reality is our world is shrinking in so many ways. And the advent of internet and instant communication and everything else. I mean, as we've said on the show before, we met briefly at what is already an international conference that probably could not exist in the size that it does without an internet presence, and did not exist in this size before that. Despite the fact that, how the heck is ISTE 75 years old? Like, am I the only one that was confused by that? Like, I'm very confused. Anyways, like, despite that, this conference is massive, and that's the thing that brought us together, and then the power of the internet allows me to connect with you after the fact, and over however much distance, able to communicate, and you and I are seeing each other, and my audience is hearing us right now, in a way that didn't exist previously, and is only going to become easier and easier as time goes on, and our children now are going to have to escape those barriers just to do business. Forget equality and education. They need that for their jobs. And yet, we're still struggling with the morality of it in our now. So it's interesting. I've just never thought about that as something that doing it is beneficial to building better future people. Or better future people, I guess I considered. But better future employees and workers.
Yeah. Sure.
You got me thinking. I like it. As you said, this you know, that discomfort is the work. I guess we gotta get them there. That is good stuff. Yeah, and I think the other thing you said is, you know, at the end of the day, we still have a gap between what we're needing to prepare our students for and what we're doing now. And I don't use the factory model of education myth anymore, because that's not what our system is based on. So I don't use that one anymore. But despite, even if you use that as the metaphor, even if it isn't, that still feels like what we're preparing kids for. It feels like the majority of classrooms I see are still preparing kids for following directions, learning what we tell them to learn, and producing the products we want them to produce. And those are three skills I don't look for in teachers. I don't look for in employees when I was running a business. And those still feel like the things that ultimately we're doing in classrooms to this day.
Right.
So how do we, what is the work we need to do now to start to build that change?
I mean, awareness, it starts with awareness first and foremost, and it starts with immense reflection. I'm a huge proponent of reflection and making and encouraging all educators to go at the end of the day, go home and, you know, once you've had your downtime to before diving into the next day, really thinking about how to make the next day in front of you a bit better. And with that, thinking about how the pieces come together in a way that we are not letting our own ideals and our own values get before us, and but also building upon our values and building upon our stories and our own narratives in ways that really connects with our students, and then looping in the narrative and the values that our students bring, such that we are achieving the just right mix of not letting our own values getting in the way, but bringing in a level of personal connection to students and to the schools that we're serving in to get to a place that our curriculum feels really meaningful, and we're pushing meaningful conversations. And whether our students are 4 years old, because they're some of the most insightful little people I know, to our 12th graders and beyond, just getting to a place where our classrooms are pushing beyond the standardized exams, or pushing beyond the average page in a textbook, or an article or a passage that we're putting in front of our students, and certainly a worksheet. Getting past those things and making sure our classrooms are electric and alive and really connecting to what students and we care about, and then through building the standards into those.
I like that. Instead of using the standards as the framework or the yellow brick, instead of using the standards as the end of goal, it's more the signpost along the journey. Is that a good way to look at it?
Yeah, for sure.
I like that. I'm good with that. Awesome. Let's move into number two. Let's move into question number two. And question number two for all my guests is, what is something you're doing that you wish all educators would do?
It's a tough question because, dare I say, but if I were pushed to make a choice, something that I'm doing every day that I wish not just educators, but I just wish humans would do, is something that I had not been doing in the past. And I'm challenging myself to make it more a baked-in skill or habit of mine, is pretty simple. It's listening more. And what I mean by that is getting to a place where we are focused less on the things that we have to say, the things that we believe and the things that we stand firm in, and just getting to a place where we're hearing more what's around us. So in my most recent role as a school leader, because of the circumstances, I was just sort of thrust into a really demanding, fast-paced role that relied heavily on execution. And I really did what I can to create the spaces and the platform for our staff members, our families, and our students to contribute to the work that we were doing by having the place and space to contribute to those things. But I also, at the same time, look at those years and say, if I weren't moving as fast as I were, there'd be more opportunities to hear more. And so I am using this time, now that I've stepped down from my role and have a little bit more control, a slight bit more of control over my calendar, to allow myself to slow down a little bit and to hear more actively. And I contribute a wonderful colleague of mine, Shauna Wells. I hope she doesn't mind me shouting her out. But we had a group retreat together recently, and she was responsible for facilitating a certain segment of the work that we were doing. And there was a point at which she assigned us the task of talking to one another for 5 minutes each and taking turns. And in the 5 minutes, we had to actively listen, meaning that we could not respond in any way. And that meant not just avoiding interjecting with our own opinions, but also literally not saying anything. So I'm one that likes to affirm when people are talking. So I like to say, and yes, and respond. It's a cultural, it's the way I grew up, and it's just my personality. And she stripped us of the right to do that for those 5 minutes. And at first it was really tough. But what I realized as I was, as the 5 minutes progressed, and what I appreciate her for, is that we were creating a space where the speaker, the person sharing their perspective, could speak from a place of a truly clean, clear canvas with no distraction, with no worry about what the other person would interject with no need to organize their thoughts, because they had this just open space to communicate what they needed. And because of the structure she created, we were forced, you knew that your listener was forced to do nothing else but listen. And so I've been trying to carry that practice into life. I've been doing it more in conversation with friends, with my clients that I work with. Even when I'm listening to the news, I'm just sitting in a place of just hearing perspectives first before responding. And I wish that all educators could adopt that practice more. And that's whether or not we're listening to the concepts that are new to us and coming to us through professional development, but most powerfully and probably most importantly to our students. So I challenge everyone to try what my colleague put before us that day. And the next time you're talking to someone, try to purely listen in silence during the entire time that they're expressing themselves. And instead of preparing the script for how you're going to respond and how you're going to put together the just right answer, be in a place where you're really listening and hearing what the other person has to say.
I know, because I've done similar activities. I would struggle way more as the person talking in that scenario than the listener. Although my wife would probably tell the opposite. I make fun of my wife a lot on this show because I know she doesn't listen to it. I've realized that in the last couple episodes.
Anyways, maybe you should co-host with her sometimes.
She's been on one episode, and mostly I just made fun of her for not listening. It is that active listening component is so hard. Sometimes it sounds cliche, but I think there's a difference between listening and hearing, right? And to me, listening just simply means I'm taking the information in and hearing. You know, I'm just popping it. Maybe it's the other way around. Hearing and listening, whichever way you want to use it. Like, one is just, you're saying the things, the words are into my brain. It's another thing entirely to really consider what it is that's being said, right? Mm. And I don't know. The thing that's always weird to me about that is people are so different. Like, I value people giving me the affirmation while I'm speaking. I want to know that they're hearing me and reacting to me. I think it's the years of teaching and now running PD. I'm watching my audience to make sure they're getting a reaction of some kind. You know, and yet in a lot of ways that does probably inform and affect what I'm actually saying. And so while I might struggle with that silence, I think it's beneficial to the speaker as much as it is to the listener, is to be able to say my thoughts on that blank canvas, as you said, and as a listener to actually hear someone's pure and real thoughts without influence of outside people. I think there's a lot of value in that.
Yeah.
On both sides.
Absolutely.
Good stuff. I like it. I like it a lot. I think if we all listened more, I would get in less fights with my wife. So I think across the board, that's pretty much what we're going for. So
it applies to everything all around.
Good. I like it. Not where I thought you would take that one, but I'm okay with it. It's good. It's good. It applies in all situations.
Sure.
All right, we got one left.
Mm-hmm.
One more. Last question I ask all my guests. Who is the best teacher you have ever had?
So I'm definitely glad I pushed you to tell me this question, because I would have felt so bad if I didn't get a chance to really go through every grade in my head and give credit to where credit's due.
It's pretty funny how many people email me or message me afterwards.
Yeah.
Like, oh, I should have said this person.
I definitely would have had regrets, because, you know, you have your surface favorites for different reasons. Excuse me. You have your surface favorite for different reasons, and you, I was really, really fortunate to have some great teachers along the way, and I could shout out some names for you for sure. I'm going to cheat and give you two. One is just in honor of one who has passed. She's no longer with us, but her name is Miss Effie Rosenborough, and she actually was my preschool teacher. And she was so committed to making sure that every child leaving her pre-K program would learn to read, or get as close to reading as possible. And she actually had me reading by the age of 3. There was already some word recognition and letter recognition, and I really just thank her and honor her memory. So I could not have answered the question without shouting her name out. But when I really gave it some thought, I could name a number of teachers across the board. I've been really fortunate, like I said. But there's one who I really wanted to take this opportunity to recognize, and that her name is Miss Dolores Morris. And she technically is not a teacher per se. She was, I believe, a social worker or counselor in our high school. And the reason I want to recognize her, and I'm going to tell her to listen to this podcast so she can hear this. The reason I recognize Miss Morris is because we went to school in a tricky place where dynamics interpersonally were a bit challenging. I could go into more detail in a whole other podcast, but the dynamics of the community at the given time were really challenging. And Miss Morris and the demographics of my high school were overall very diverse, but the programming was extremely segregated. And the faces of the students who were in honors programs versus the faces of the students who were in special education programs versus the faces of students who got the highest quality guidance counseling that put them on a path to college, it was very, very segregated and absolutely by race. And so Miss Morris at the time was the coordinator of what was called the African Culture Club. And it was one of the very few spaces, if not the only space, in all of my entire high school experience where our heritage, our history, our self-pride, and our self-image was so amplified and so celebrated and so deeply interwoven in our experience. And that was whether or not we were taking a really rich scholarly article or a recent newspaper headline or a recent talk show. And we would come in and it was our after-school program, and we would be there sometimes till 5-6 o'clock at night debating some of the hottest topics in politics or in history. But these were all topics that deeply related to us and our identity and deeply helped us to prepare for what we would experience throughout the world. And we had a step team. I was the captain of the step team, and we would perform and we would travel. And the number of hours that Miss Morris volunteered to ensure that the Black students in the school had a place where we felt really welcome, where we felt really celebrated, and where we were getting, quite frankly, history about ourselves that we just were not getting in the traditional curriculum, she was really committed to that. The reason why I celebrate her is because what I realize now as an adult who has now run schools, who now understands the dynamics of our school districts a bit better, and who in particular understands some of the challenges that we were experiencing as children in the high school, but seeing it now through an adult lens, I'm realizing the amount of courage it took for Miss Morris in that context to be one of the only faculty members of color on the entire staff. To be pushing so passionately for and defending what was considered really controversial programming, because there was a lot of pushback from staff at the time, from some of the white students at the time, about what the club was about and who it was promoting and who it was welcome in. And Miss Morris, I remember a couple of years there where she was just particularly insistent that she would offer this program. And I remember at one point she said, "Y'all, if I have to have y'all come over to my house, we're going to be having this club." And she just really made sure that there was a space for us. And I know hands down that being in that club changed my life. It changed my capacity to walk in a room with a level of self-pride and self-confidence and the ability to celebrate my heritage and my background in ways that don't have any shame and don't have any that is not self-questioning in any way, even in the face of critics or in the face of folks who question whether or not these particular pieces are, you know, have a rightful place in our curriculum. So shout outs to Miss Morris. She's awesome. And I hope she hears this and it puts a smile on her face for all of the sacrifices she made for us at that time.
Yeah, I think, you know, to me, it points out that despite the fact that we are dealing with systemic issues and we're dealing with issues compounded on issues compounded on issues and connections between social issues making their way into our classrooms and things being so much larger than it feels like one person can tackle, at the same time, one teacher willing to take that risk and do something different and something better can still change lives.
For sure. Hands down, she changed my life.
And I think, given our conversation today, like, you know, we talked about some massive stuff in the beginning and ways systems are overlapping and no one person or one solution can solve all of them. And yes, that discomfort is the work, 100%. But doing something can still be worthwhile. And I think that's a nice way to tie this whole episode together. I'm really happy with that. That's good stuff. So thank you, Cheyenne, because this has been a great discussion. I feel like I've learned a lot and had a lot of great thoughts. And I think I'm definitely left with the discomfort is exactly what I'm hoping all my audience is left with on this one. And I think that's great. I really appreciate your time.
Awesome. Thank you very, very much. Thanks for having me. I'm so glad you popped into my session that day and that my words stuck with you in some way. And I hope that it continues to do so.
Absolutely. For my audience, in case they would like to reach out or get a hold of you in any way, what would be the best way for them to get a hold of you?
Yeah. So you can look up Firefly Worldwide on the internet, the interwebs. That's www.letsfirefly, like let's go, letsfirefly.com. You can find me on Twitter at Shy Says, that's C-H-E-Y, like the first letters of my name, Says. excuse me. You can find the company's Twitter page at Let's Firefly on Twitter and on Instagram at Let's Firefly as well. Join in. I'm posting all the time about these issues and just my latest thoughts of the day.
All right. And of course, links to all of those will be in the show notes. So you can click right over and jump right to any of those pages as you may want to. And check out Cheyenne. I highly recommend it. She's got good stuff going on. And, you know, you gotta be impressed by somebody that's goal is to be a global change leader and make education on a global scale better. So I can't argue with that. You know, I can't.
Thank you so much for that. And thanks again for the opportunity to be on. And for sure, if anyone out there is looking for more support with strategic planning and execution, professional development, and certainly how to plug diversity, equity, and inclusion more into your work in more thoughtful ways, give a shout, and I would love to talk.
Absolutely. Thanks again, Cheyenne. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Brad. Talk to you soon.
Cheyenne, thank you so much for a great chat. It was really something to think about and let sink in. To connect with Cheyenne, you can find her on Twitter at ShaySays, or find Firefly Worldwide at www.letsfirefly.com, or on Twitter at letsfirefly, and the same on Instagram. And of course, links to all of those are in the show notes. If you have comments or questions about the show, you can always connect with me on Twitter or Instagram at Brad Schreffler. I love to hear from you guys there, and that's also a great place to connect if you'd like to be a guest on the show. Or check out the feedback page on my website that gives you additional options for feedback, which you can find at bradschreffler.com/feedback. Until next week, remember to sit in your discomfort.
Music for the Planning Period podcast is the song Vicious by Kevin MacLeod, used under Creative Commons. You can find him at incompetech.com. The Planning Period podcast is also a proud member of the VoiceEd Radio Network, a 24-hour radio network all about education all the time. VoiceEd Radio. Your voice is right here.